Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the second installment on our series of Becoming the Best Version of Ourselves, a series which tries to draw the best from the genre of productivity literature, self-help, growth, business books, combined and integrated with our Torah's timeless teachings. I want to talk a little bit about what we covered in part one. For those who didn't see it, who weren't here, you can watch it in video or listen online. And then we'll get into tonight's topic. Last time we met, we spoke about the feeling that is pervasive among so many, a feeling of drowning, of suffocating. So many things are competing for our time, our attention, our energy, family, business, professional, social, spiritual, and it can feel overwhelming at times. That we live in a time in which people think it's somehow impressive to say crazy busy, psycho busy, insanely busy, that somehow the busier you are, the more important you are, the better, more superior you are, when in fact, as we talked about, it's the exact opposite. The busier you are, it means the less discipline you have in your life, the more scattered, the more fragmented you are. We have limited time. Every one of us in this room and around the world has a total of 168 hours in the week. You can't buy more hours. There's nothing you can do. When it comes to money, as a resource, as a commodity, you can work harder. You can make more money. You could recover loss. But when it comes to time, there is nothing anyone can do to gain more time. We all have the same 168 hours in a week in the shape of an hourglass because the time is moving. It's slipping away and nothing we can do to change it. We talked about what we do shows what we really want to be doing. The idea, the difference between wanting to want to be doing and wanting to do. We do what we want to do. There are things we claim we want to do that we don't want to do. We want to do. I want to exercise more often. I want to lose weight. I want to get more sleep. But if we wanted to do it, we would be doing it. That we have the free will to prioritize our lives, to make choices. That we have 168 hours, how will we spend them? If you subtract the hours we sleep, the hours we eat, the hours which are beyond our control, that are not there for us to dictate, we only have a finite amount of hours left a week. How do we want to spend them? How do we want to spend them? I was once talking to somebody who was playing golf 4 or 5 times a week. And when he calculated the 168 hours minus the amount of time that you sleep, you eat, you shower, you go to the bathroom, your obligations, and he realized how small the amount of time left to choose was, he said, 15, 16, 18 hours a week on golf? No way. And he reorganized his entire life. There's nothing wrong with enjoying a golf game. There's nothing wrong with recreation. There's nothing wrong with being outdoors. But while time feels infinite, in fact, it's very finite. We talked about the idea of sharpening your saw, the seventh habit of Covey's Seven Habits. That the great President Abraham Lincoln once said, if you were given 5 hours to cut down a tree, you would spend 4 hours sharpening the axe and 1 hour cutting down the tree. If you have a dull blade, you could spend all 5 hours exerting your energy, killing yourself, or you could work smarter, sharpen the blade, sharpen the axe, sharpen the saw, and life will be more efficient, more productive, less stressful, less strenuous. And lastly, last time we talked about creating more margin in our lives. We saw the examples in Torah of the space, the break in the text in which Moses turns to God and says, give me some margin, give me some space, allow me to absorb and to think and to analyze and to be changed and transformed from what you've told me. No book has the ink or the writing go from the edge of the page to the edge of the page, from the top to the bottom. There's margin, there's white space. The white space is where we think. The white space is where we're transformed. Life is filled, but it needs white space in between. That was all last time. What I want to begin this evening with is more on the concept of free will and more on our ability to choose. It's critically important to be intentional about everything we do. You know, studies show that an enormous amount of our life, we are creatures of habit. Whether you were late tonight or you were on time tonight, whether you overate at dinner or whether you stopped when you were full, what you talked about, so much of what happened just in the last hour was a function of the habits that you, that we have formed. Too many of us are on autopilot. Momentum is carrying us forward. But if we want to make changes in our life, if we want to be the best version of ourselves that we deserve to realize, that our family deserves to have, that God has put us on a mission to achieve, to be the best version of ourselves, we can't afford to blindly be sleepwalking through life, to allow momentum to carry us. But rather, we have to be intentional. Intentional about the choices we make. Intentional about the priorities we set. Intentional about what takes up our time. Intentional about our relationships. Intentional about our conversations. To be intentional about what we do. Greg McKeon, the author of the book Essentialism, which we introduced last time, we'll draw from tonight as well, has a phenomenal quote. If you don't prioritize your life, someone else will. If you don't prioritize your life, someone else will. Could be your spouse, could be your boss, it could be your rabbi, it could be whatever other pressure, influence, people are in your life. Either we choose to prioritize our lives, or our lives will be prioritized by others. There's a song by Rush, the band Rush. The song is called Free Will. And there's a lyric in that song. If you choose not to decide, you still have made a choice. If you choose not to decide, you have still made a choice. And we think we're just going with the flow. We are just easygoing. We allow things to unfold. We allow it to happen. But if we choose not to make decisions in our lives, those are also choices that we're making that impact us. The word decision is a very interesting word. The word decision comes from the Latin, decisio, which means a cutting off. That shoresh, I don't know if Latin has roots, but the root of that Latin word, the C-I-S-I-O, think about that word, incision, precision, excision. In all of those, what it means is to cut. Well, a decision is a cutting off. When you make a decision, you had been presented with alternatives. Maybe a finite amount, maybe an infinite amount. Maybe a narrow group, or maybe a broad choice. But you have alternatives. What to do in the next hour? Who to talk to? What relationship to build upon? Where to invest your money? How to spend your time? What book to read? Whether to watch TV? There's a million choices we make. We're presented with a ton of alternatives. And when we make the decision, there's been a cutting off. We've eliminated all the choices, and we've left one. We've shown the courage to make a decision. On the one hand, it seems very restrictive. You make a decision, you've locked yourself in. You make a decision about what you're going to do. You are a decisive person. You've locked yourself in. But on the other hand, it's incredibly liberating to have all of those options, to be wavering in between, to be unsure of what you want to do next. If you've been to the supermarket lately, I don't go often, but when I'm in the supermarket, you go to the condiment aisle. You stand in front of the salad dressings, which take up today an entire aisle. There's almost, it seems, an infinite amount of choices among salad dressings. And it's not liberating to have so many choices. It's incredibly stress-inducing. Which one? And what if the other one was better? And this one has more of this, but that one has more of that. And I don't know which one. Should I pick the price, the health, the flavor, the... Which one should I choose? It's overwhelming. So many people don't make choices, not about the salad dressing, but about other critical things in life. When you make a decision, there's been a cutting off. You have eliminated the alternatives. You've chosen one way. It takes courage, but it's liberating. Habit number one, what I want to start with tonight. Stephen Covey's 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. It's an unbelievable sefer. I'm not calling it a book. The wisdom, and as we'll see, how it correlates with our Torah teachings, it's practically a sefer. It contains unbelievable wisdom. Last week we covered the 7th habit, sharpening the saw. Sharpening the saw, Covey said, was that if you spend all your time exerting yourself, your blade is dull. You're exhausted. You're unfocused. You're inefficient. You're stressed out. You're drawn in many directions. But if you can create the margin in your life to take care of the 4 areas that are critically important, your emotional health, your physical health, your spiritual health, to be able to dedicate time to caring for yourself. If you keep your soul sharp, you'll be efficient and productive in the other areas of your life and during the other hours of your day. That was the seventh habit. And I began with it last week because I told you that in many ways I think what he calls the seventh habit really should be the first. If you haven't learned to create margin, if you don't make the space to stay sharp and implement everything else, how can you really achieve the other six? But tonight I want to come full circle to his first habit. And Covey's first habit is be proactive. What does that mean? Be proactive. Is being proactive as opposed to being passive? No. We'll see in a moment. But Covey says, if you don't master, or master maybe is a strong word, but if you're not growing in the first habit, learning to be proactive in life, then you can't achieve the other habits. You're not going to cover ground or make progress in the other areas. If you don't believe you have the strength to be proactive, to be intentional in the choices you make, then you've conceded your life to others. So if you decide that how you feel and what you do and what you believe and how you prioritize are all going to be shaped by everything around you, so how you feel will be a function of the weather outside. And what you're doing this Sunday is a function of other people dictating and pressuring you to do. And what you choose to spend your money on and how you allocate your life and what you prioritize is all conditioned from around you. You're not being proactive. You're being reactive. You have conceded your life to others. If you don't prioritize your life, others will. We're told the story in the book of Exodus and Shmos. Jewish people have gone down to Egypt. They are enslaved in servitude, suffering, oppression, persecution, years and years and years of slavery. And the Torah tells us, the Bible tells us, that God recruits Moshe. Moses is the leader of the Jewish people. And he tells them, I have a mission for you. You're going to go down to Egypt. You're going to look into these people's eyes and you're going to tell them they have a brighter future. There is a brighter day ahead. Not to give in, not to give up, not to be hopeless. To hold on. Things will turn around. And God says, tell the children of Israel, I'm the Lord. I will take you out from under the burdens of Egypt. I will save you from the labor. I will redeem you. I will take you to me as a people. And you will know that I am the Lord your God. I will bring you to the land. There are four languages of redemption. Dalad Lashonos of Geula. We commemorate these four languages of redemption every year. When we observe Pesach, when we observe Passover, and we relive, we commemorate the leaving of Egypt, we drink how many cups of wine? Four glasses of wine. One for each of these languages of redemption. So God sends Moshe on this mission. And if you're Moshe, you say, this is a phenomenal mission. Has anyone ever been sent on a better mission? I have to go tell a people that are imprisoned, that are persecuted, that are suffering, that are breaking their backs in work, that have no idea of a brighter future. I get to be the one to come and herald the dawn of a new era and tell them, guess what? God loves you. He's going to take you out. He's going to bring you in. He's going to take you to the land. If I'm Moshe, I'm so excited. Moshe makes his way down to Egypt. He faces the people. And what's their reaction? The last verse, verse 9. Vayedaber Moshe kein al b'nei Yisrael. Moshe spoke to the children of Israel. He relayed the message accurately. But what happened? V'lo shamu el Moshe mikotzer ruach u'me'avodah kasha. They didn't listen. They shut down. They shut him out. They just kept building the bricks, building the pyramids, breaking their backs. They just kept suffering. They pushed Moshe away. They rejected his message. They never heard him. Why? What happened? What went wrong? Who wouldn't want to hear such a message of liberation, of freedom, of redemption? It's a commentary, the Or HaChaim HaKadosh, Rav Chaim Ibn Attar. He lived in Morocco and then he moved to Jerusalem and he writes a beautiful insight. He says, the translation of the words, the Jewish people weren't able to hear him. Why? Mikotzer ruach, which literally translates, they were out of breath. They were working so hard. They were so crazy busy. And they were so overwhelmed that they couldn't hear. Mikotzer ruach, shortness of breath. They were running, 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 doing, working, working, working. There was no margin. There was no space. There was no place for hope, for optimism, for belief. I mean, avodah kasha, it was the back-breaking labor. But the Ora Chaim comes and he says, no, it wasn't shortness of breath from busyness, busyness, busyness. The word ruach can mean breath, but the word ruach can also mean vision, a spirit. They were despondent. They had given up hope. They had conceded and forfeited their lives, their autonomy. They were slaves. They gave up hope. They didn't believe it could ever get better. And so many of us suffer the same way. Think it's never going to change. This is me. I'm the fat person. I'm the late person. I'm the cheap person. I'm the poor person. I'm the underachieving person. I'm the quick to anger person. I'm the I have no patience person. It's who I am. It's what I am. It's not going to change. It's not going to change. I've shared the story of when I was sitting on the bima and I heard somebody breathing heavily. I thought they were asleep. I looked over. They were awake. But they were breathing so heavily, I realized, because they were not in a healthy position in life. I approached the person and I begged him. I said, you know, it's not my business. I hate to interfere, but I care about you. So I want to suggest that perhaps you want to start taking care of yourself. I can hear the heavy breathing, the kotzer ruach, from far away. What do you say? Go for a walk. And he looked me in the eye and he said, Rabbi, it's not me. It's not me. So what do you mean it's not you? It's not you to be healthy, to live, add years to your life. It's not you to be able to get on the floor and play with your grandchildren. It's not you to be able to sit in a room and everyone doesn't hear you breathing. And he said, yeah, it's just not me. And it's a longer story, not for now. I went back to him two more times, even suggesting, I will meet you every day and go for a walk with you. I wasn't ready to give up. But you know what? His power of it's just not me overwhelmed my sense of eagerness to help, to try to be of influence. But we all suffer in different ways. It's just not me to stop gossiping. It's just not me to not watch TV and instead read something. It's just not me to save money. It's just not me. Mikotzer ruach. We don't only have a shortness of breath from our busyness and our workload and our exhaustion, but we have a lack of vision of a brighter future, of another day, of being different. And it doesn't matter what age you are. There are people who transform their lives in their 90th decade, their 100th decade on this world. It doesn't matter what age you are, but it begins with believing things can be different. The first habit is being proactive, is believing that it's within our power, it's within our reach to make those changes to achieve those dreams. Covey says, to go from being reactive to proactive, your life is a product of your values, not your feelings. Life is a product of your values, not your feelings. This is very hard in our generation. Covey wrote his book, his worldwide best-selling book many years ago. He's since passed away. The 21st century is all about feelings. What makes me feel good, what I want to do, what I need to feel. But Covey says life is not about feelings. It's not about how I feel, what makes me feel good. It's about values. Being proactive is about identifying your values and then creating a lifestyle that is commensurate, a lifestyle that realizes those values. Not what are your feelings and what feels good, but what are your values. And then Covey says, your life is a product of decisions, not your conditions. What your life looks like and the result of your life is of your decisions, from the Latin, what you've cut off and what you've left, not your conditions. What does he mean by that? The opposite of being proactive is being reactive, right? Not that I'm crafting a life based on my values, but I'm reacting. I'm reacting to my family, I'm reacting to my work, I'm reacting to the pressures, I'm reacting to keeping up, I'm reacting to envy, I'm reacting, reacting, reacting. Being proactive is not reacting to the things around you. Of course, you integrate the things around you into the how you choose to be proactive. But being proactive is not reactive. The opposite of being proactive is being impulsive, is being impetuous, is just feeling like you want to do something, something feeling good, and so you do it. Impulse buys. How 50% of this country have more debt than savings. Why? Because it feels good to order that thing on Amazon. It feels good to go to the mall and go shopping. Ah, you put it on a credit card for money that you don't have, but it feels good. It feels good. That's a reactive life based on feelings, not a proactive life based on decisions. Covey says that proactive people take responsibility. They don't blame the circumstances. They don't blame people, and we're going to unpack this in a moment. They don't blame everything around them. If only she were more this, if only they were more that, if only I had a bigger house, if only I had the opportunity, if only I were healthy, if only everything around me were different, my life would look different. That's a reactive person. A proactive person is responsible for themselves, for their choices, and for the results. Covey says the etymology of the word responsibility is responsibility. It's your ability to respond. Do you respond to things around you? Do you take responsibility? Do you blame everything around you? Or do you respond and transform everything around you? I want to tell you the story of Elazar ben Derdiah. Some of you are familiar with it. It's from the Talmud, the Gemara of Avodah Zarah 17a. And the Gemara here tells the story. We won't read it inside. Elazar ben Derdiah, the rabbis did not have very flattering things to say about him. What was he most known for, Elazar ben Derdiah? Say the rabbis, he had solicited the services of every prostitute on earth. Everyone available to him, he had visited. But there was one left, and she was supposedly the most beautiful. Elazar ben Derdiah couldn't be satisfied with what he had. It was what he didn't have. So the one he hadn't been with, the Gemara, the Talmud describes the great lengths that he went to in order to be with her. He traversed seven rivers. He climbed mountains. He did whatever it took in order to be able to arrive at her destination. And Elazar ben Derdiah uses her services. He negotiates the deal. They undress and they begin to be together. And at the moment of intimacy, the Talmud testifies, this woman essentially, I'll give you this version, believe it or not, is the cleaner version, she burps in his face. She expels air in his face. Elazar ben Derdiah is a little shocked. He's paying top dollar. She's supposedly the most beautiful, best prostitute on earth. And at this moment of being together, this is what she does. But she adds insult to injury because she turns to him and she says, the same way my breath will not return to me, so too Elazar ben Derdiah's repentance will never be accepted. Just like I can't get that breath back, you, Elazar ben Derdiah, can never recover a sense of purity. You can never repent. There's no coming back. Could you imagine being rebuked by a prostitute? Musar by a zona? Elazar ben Derdiah is taken aback. He leaves her presence. And the Talmud tells us that he goes out. He's shaken, he's rattled to his core. What do you mean? I'm so corrupt. I'm so contaminated. I'm so overcome by the virus in my being. I can't repair. I can't return. I can't repent. The Talmud tells us that Elazar ben Derdiah goes out and he sits between the mountains and he says, mountains, please intervene on my behalf to the Almighty. Advocate for me to have a second chance. The mountains turn to him and they say, I'm sorry, buddy, you're on your own. He goes to the rivers and the seas and he says, please, advocate for me. Run interference with God. They say, sorry, buddy, you're on your own. He turns to the sun and the moon, to the stars and the constellations. He employs everyone he could and he says, please, lobby on my behalf. Ask, make God, give me a second chance. He says, sorry, buddy, you're on your own. And the Talmud describes that at that moment, when he had turned to everyone around him and he said, please, bring me back to purity. Please achieve repentance for me. And they all said, you're on your own. At that moment, Elazar ben Derdiah said the fateful words, Ein hadavar talui ella bi. The matter rests with me alone. I guess it all comes down to me. The Talmud says he sat, he put his knees between his legs, he began to weep, to cry. At that moment his soul left his body. He died. And a heavenly voice came out and it proclaimed, not Elazar ben Dordaya, but it proclaimed, Rabbi Elazar ben Dordaya is invited to the world to come. That's the Talmud. That's the story. What's going on in this story? Let's unfold this story. Elazar ben Dordaya has become so corrupted ethically, his values were so absent, that even this Zona, this harlot, says to him, there's no coming back. He turns to everything around him. They say, sorry, buddy, you're on your own. I think the Talmud is telling us that so many of us as well, we confront shortcoming, we confront things that need to change, deficiency, inadequacy in our lives, and we look for the solution everywhere around us. I just have to hear the next speech, read the next book. I just have to change the way you behave. I need to set up, everything around us has to change, and then we'll find our solution. But Elazar ben Dordaya learns the hard way that everything around him says, sorry buddy, it's not for us. And it's only the moment he realizes, Ein hadavar talui ela bi, that the matter rests with me alone, when he takes what Covey calls, what would Covey call it? He takes responsibility. When he shows and displays the ability to respond, that it's about him, that he can't turn or look to or be supported by anything around him. He and he alone has to make the choice to change. Only then does he achieve entrance into the world to come. He sits with his head between his knees. It's the fetal position. He goes back to the purity, to the origin. He takes personal responsibility. He decides he needs to be proactive, not respond to everything around him, not blame everything around him, but respond. January 5th, 2009, one of our top-rated shows of the year, Oprah Winfrey made a public confession. I'm not ranking on Oprah Winfrey. Probably we can relate to this confession. She made a public confession on that show she had at the time that she had regained all the weight that she had so publicly lost. In fact, this was the cover of her magazine, January 2009. The cover of her own magazine contrasts at her lowest weight and the fact that she had regained it all. And you see the headline is, how did I let this happen again? She said on the show that day, I am so embarrassed. All the fame and all the attention and all the glamorous life and success doesn't mean one thing if you can't control your own being. All the glamour, all the fame, all the money, all the success, if you can't control your own being. How did I let this happen again? The episode, her statement, this edition of the magazine, left many people puzzled. America's self-help queen. Is Oprah not America's self-help queen? Why could the self-help queen not help herself? She can afford and has a personal trainer, a personal chef, a nutritionist, a staff, and yet, every day she has on her show, or then did, a next self-help guru, self-help author, self-help coach, self-help expert, and here she was confessing to America. She had access to everything and everyone, and I don't know how this happened again. All the fame and all the fortune and all the celebrity doesn't mean one thing if you can't control your own being. Here's why it happened. There's a book called Sham, How the Self-Help Movement Made America Helpless. Steve Salerno is the author. He explains that there's a symptom of a greater phenomenon. That as it turns out, research shows that the self-help genre does more damage than good. And why does it do more damage than good? Because it promotes and reinforces the idea that I just need to read the right book. I just need to hear the right speaker. I just need to hire the right coach. I just need the right trainer. If only I had the right solution outside of me, then I would achieve my goals. And what does that do? When you reinforce the notion that the solution is outside of you, you're not proactive. You're not showing responsibility. Salerno says, quote, the culture of self-help teaches people to rely on things that don't provide an answer. Hope, trust the universe, believe, achieve. The majority of people who buy self-help books tend to buy similar books on the same topic over and over again. The hope is that one day something is going to click. I know somebody who spends so much of their money and so much of their time attending the next seminar, hiring the next person, reading the next thing, that they, their own life, which needs the changes to happen, haven't happened because there's no space, because he's perpetually running after the next great thing to help him change. As long as we maintain the illusion that the solution is outside of ourselves, we will never change. It's a sham. In fact, the Ramban tells us, we read in Parshas Nitzavim, the book of Deuteronomy, Ki ha-mitzvah hazos asher anochi mitzavcha hayom. I won't sing this great Avraham Fried song for you. But this commandment that I give you today, God says, is not hidden from you. Lo rechokahi, it's not far away. I have a commandment. And it's not in heaven that you say, who will go up to heaven and get it for us? Nor is it beyond the sea that you'll say, who can cross the sea and go fetch it for us? But rather, ki karov eilecha hadavar ma'od. It's right here. It's right there. It's accessible. It's right under your nose. It's right in front of your eyes. Where is it? Beficha uvilvavcha la'asosa. It's in your mouth and it's in your heart to do. What is this ki ha-mitzvah hazos? God says, the mitzvah! You think mistakenly it's in the heavens. Who's going to climb up there and get it? It's over the sea. Who's going to cross the sea to grab onto it? But no, it's right in front of you. It's accessible easily to you. Where is it? It's in your mouth and it's in your heart. What's that mitzvah? Says Nachmanides the Ramban, it is the mitzvah of tshuva. It's the capacity to change. Long before Salerno and the book Sham, the Ramban tells us the solution to change is not outside yourself. It's beficha, it's in your mouth, and it's bilvavcha, it's in your heart. Dr. Tal Ben Shachar, the world's authority on happiness, taught the most popular class in the history of Harvard, The Science of Happiness, has written numerous best-selling books, Choose the Life You Want, The Mindful Way to Happiness. At the lecture he gave here at the Boca Raton Synagogue a couple years ago, he said the following very self-defeating statement. He said, if you want to change, don't buy self-help books, including my own, he said. If you want to learn about happiness, read my book. But if you want to change, don't buy from the self-help genre. Where should you buy from? Which section of Barnes & Noble should you go to? Biographical. Biographies. If you want to be inspired to change, read biographies. That was his message that night, one of the many brilliant messages. Why? Why is a biography a greater catalyst for change than the next best self-help book, which has all the answers? Because the self-help book continues to promote the solution is outside you. Whereas the biography is an example of somebody who found the solution from within. You read the biography of a great rabbi, of a great scholar, of a great president, of a great leader, and you see the choices, the decisions, the responsibility, the transformation they undertook from within. It'll motivate you to do the same. To do this, to be proactive, to take responsibility, language matters. Don't be resigned to a reality. Kotzer ruach u'avoda kasha. I'm the fat one, I'm the angry one, I'm the impatient one, I'm the whatever one. Don't be resigned to a reality. Don't be hopeless. Don't surrender to the circumstances that surround you. And the language we use to be proactive or reactive matters. Language matters. Reactive language becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. You see somebody who makes you react a certain way. You experience something that makes you react a certain way. Oh boy, it's cloudy out, it's raining, it's cold again. It's going to be a miserable day. If you react to the world around you, your life will become a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's an amazing study I came across from the Journal of Consumer Research. 120 students were divided into two groups. One instructed to respond to facing temptation with the words, I can't, and the other with the words, I don't. If offered ice cream, the first group was instructed to say, I can't eat ice cream. And the second group was given the same temptation. They were to respond, I don't eat ice cream. Now you'd say that's a matter of semantics. I can't eat ice cream. I don't eat ice cream. In both cases, I'm refraining from eating the ice cream. Each group repeated their phrase over and over again, right? The instructor who spoke to the group that had enlisted for the study, obviously not knowing what they were being studied for, were given the expression, the phrase. They were given it separately. You're going to be offered something. It may tempt you. I want you to say, I can't eat ice cream. I can't eat ice cream. They repeated it over and over. The second group, you're going to maybe presented with a temptation. I want you to say over and over, I don't eat ice cream. I don't eat ice cream. Good. They went through the exercise of repeating the phrase over and over and over again. And then, having no idea what was being studied or what they'd be presented, they were each given a questionnaire. And the questionnaire had absolutely nothing to do with the study. What's your favorite sports team? What's your mother? Nothing to do with the study whatsoever. It was designed to distract them, to interrupt the study. They were each given a questionnaire. They filled out the questionnaire having nothing to do with the study. And when they handed in the questionnaire, which probably was summarily thrown in the garbage, they handed in the questionnaire. On the way out of the room, they were offered a candy bar or ice cream. And listen to the result. The study found that those who said, I can't eat X, chose the candy bar 61% of the time. And those who said, I don't eat X, only chose it 36% of the time. Everything else about them was equal. Everything else about them was the same. The study was conducted scientifically. The only difference between the two groups was whether they had just repeated the mantra over and over, I can't, or they repeated the mantra of I don't. And the result of the change of the one word, can't, to don't, made a difference of 25, a lot of percentage points, of less people eating the ice cream. Researchers concluded the very terminology we use influence our will, discipline, and self-control. Heidi Grant Halverson, the director of the Motivation Science Center at Columbia University, said, quote, I don't is experienced as a choice, so it feels empowering. I don't. I've chosen not to. It's a decision. I don't. It's empowering. It's an affirmation of our determination and willpower. I can't isn't a choice. It's a restriction. It's being imposed upon you. So thinking I can't undermines your sense of power and personal agency. That's how she explains it. Put it differently, if you say I don't, it's psychologically empowering. If you say I can't, it's psychologically draining way of saying no. Both of them are ways of saying no. Both are turning down the ice cream or the candy bar. But turning it down with I can't is draining. I really want to. I wish I could. I'm dying for it, but I can't. Versus I don't. I've chosen not to. I don't. The language we use impacts whether we are proactive or reactive. It influences our lives. Covey has, in this habit number one, be proactive means using the correct language. Our language is a very real indicator of the degree to which we see ourselves as proactive people. And let me give you some examples, which it's easy to dismiss as semantics. But as we just saw from that study, not in Covey's book, obviously, it's later, but as we just saw from the study, that language matters. Here are some contrasts Covey offers. Reactive language is, there's nothing I can do. Proactive language is, let's look for alternatives. Reactive language, it's just the way I am. Proactive language, I can choose a different approach. Reactive, he makes me so mad. Proactive language, I can control my feelings. I can't control him, but I can control how he makes me feel. Reactive, they won't allow that. Proactive, I can create an effective presentation. Reactive, I have to do that. Proactive, I choose an appropriate response. Reactive language is I can't. Proactive is I choose. Reactive, I must. Proactive, I prefer. Reactive is if only. Proactive is I will. Here you have side-by-side examples of two different ways of saying the same thing, or two different ways of responding. One is reactive, and one is taking the same circumstances and choosing to be proactive. Choosing to take responsibility. Choosing to create results. Covey talks about the difference between the haves and the bees. Haves. Haves are the people who are paralyzed in life by the sense that if only I had, I'll be happy when I have my house paid off. If only I had a boss who wasn't such a dictator. If only I had a more patient husband or wife. If I could just have more time to myself. That's to live life from the position of have. If I had a bigger house, if I had more car, if I had my health, if I had more money, if I had a different boss, if I didn't have, if I had different children, if I had, have. You can be stuck in if only I had. Or you can choose to be. I can be more patient. I can be more wise. I can be more loving. I can take the cards I've been dealt and play a different hand. The reactive person is obsessed with the cards. The proactive person is choosing how to play them. The choice is how we want to lead our lives. You can be sad and broken and downtrodden. You can be miserable and fabisana. You can be exude negative energy. Where you can choose to take whatever cards you've been dealt, but play the hand. Be instead of have. Proactive instead of reactive. Have the ability to respond and shape your own life with whatever the circumstances, often difficult and challenging, that have been dealt our way. Anytime we think the problem is out there, says Kavi, that thought is the problem. Anytime we think the problem is out there, that thought is the problem. The problem is my boss, the problem is my spouse, the problem is my in-laws, the problem is the car, the problem is the house, the problem is the job, the problem is the health, the problem is the shul, the problem is the... Anytime we think the problem is out there, that thought is the problem. Be the change. Be the responsibility. Make and craft and shape the life you want. It's interesting, in the Seven Habits, very timely for our parsha, our Torah portion, Covey, a religious man, says... The best example or illustration he has of being focused on be rather than have, the phenomenon of if only I had, is none other than the story of Joseph. He tells the whole story in the Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. Habit number one. Joseph's life is riddled by circumstances of have. If only I had brothers who were nice to me. If only I had not been thrown in a pit. If only I had not been sold into slavery. If only I had not been falsely accused. If only I weren't languishing in prison. If only. Have. Does Joseph choose to focus on have? Does he recoil? Does he fall back in life with a sense of victimhood and martyrdom? Is he passive aggressive, looking for the sympathy of the universe? No. Joseph is not consumed by have. Joseph chooses to be. In every one of those circumstances, he doesn't sit, woe is me, if only I had. He chooses to be, and he brings about his own solution. Sitting in prison, having absolutely every entitlement or license to wallow in his own sorrows, instead he looks over and he sees two prison mates who look all downtrodden and depressed. And he says, hey brothers, what's the matter? Why such a sad face? What's going on? They say, well, if you want to know, we had these pretty horrible dreams. We're not sure what they mean. They're making us nervous. And he says, dreams? It just happens to be that God's given me a talent to interpret dreams. Tell me the dreams. And what does he do? He sets in motion his own redemption. Because 2 years later, when one of those inmates had been freed and is in the palace of the king, and the king has a terrible dream, he says, if only I had someone to interpret my dream. That prison mate says, oh, I know just the guy. Would that have happened if Joseph were sitting in the corner of the cell wallowing in his own sorrow? It's because Joseph, instead of choosing to focus on the have, if only I had, he chose to be, to care about another, to ask, what's the matter, brother? To offer them a solution, which in turn became his own solution. Covey tells the story of Joseph as the example of the contrast between the haves and the bees. This slide alone is so critically important for marriage. So critically important for marriage. In the 4-part series we did by Dr. John Gottman and Torah and marriage, and I encourage you to listen online, we talked all about the language that we use, the framing we do in communication and conflict resolution, in navigating and negotiating the differences we have. And each member in the couple can either choose to focus on the have, if only I had a spouse that X, Y, and Z, or they can choose to be. You can't change other people, but you can change how they make you feel. And when you change how you react, often they will change their pattern of behavior itself. We can't change other people. Try, but that's Einstein's definition of insanity. Trying the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. Every Pesach, this time it'll be different. Every Thanksgiving, every time the family, every time the friends, every time the... We can try, or we can change the way that people around us make us feel. That's the be versus the have, if only they were different. In life, it's easy to be carried by momentum, to not be intentional in all that we do, to simply go with the flow and float downstream. You know what swims downstream? A dead fish. A dead fish swims downstream. Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamy should have good health, has a great insight, also timely, for this week's Torah portion. He says the following. The 85 letters of the two verses that we sing when we take the Torah from the Ark, Vayhi ben Soah Aaron, before the reading of the Torah, appear in the Torah surrounded by two strange symbols, one at the beginning of the passage and one at the end. They are the Nun Hafuchim, upside down Hebrew letters Nun. The reason for the strange use of the orthographic symbols is offered by Kabbalistic work, and it's even stranger than the symbols themselves. The Midrash says they are actual glory of the Holy One, the foundation of the world. By means of these Nuns, the Holy One will redeem Israel and bring the Messiah. And it's by means of these Nuns that Jacob blessed his grandchildren. As it says, V'yidgu larov bekerev ha'aretz. What in the world does the Midrash mean? What's the connection between the brackets outside the song we sing when we take the Torah out and the blessing Jacob gives his grandchildren in this week's Torah portion? The last item refers to the root of V'yidgu, which is dag, or fish. Jacob blessed his grandchildren that they increase as profusely as the fish of the sea, that they have as many children as the fish of the sea. I suggest, says Rabbi Lamb, that what this extravagant praise of the inverted nuns means is this. In order to bring the redemption, to set the world aright and justify its continued existence, to bring the spirit of divinity into the world, what is necessary is the readiness to do what fish do, to swim upstream, to go against the tide, to dare the raging currents of the foaming sea. It means the ability to you, to your vision, even when the masses declare you blind or unfit, even when the powers of the world or community disparage you and isolate you. The blessing that redemption, the Messiah, will come when we tap into the nuns, and this is Jacob's blessing, it has to do with the fish, the willingness to swim upstream, to not be passive, to not be reactive. A dead fish can swim downstream. Only a live fish can swim upstream. Are you alive or are you dead, sleepwalking through life? Coming back to essentialism, we began last time. The phenomenal book, Greg McKeon, about reducing our lives to that which is essential. That doesn't mean to neglect things that are important, but it simply means to be proactively making the choice. Again, if you don't prioritize your life, someone else will. And here again, language becomes important. Says Craig McKeon, the non-essentialist thinks, I have to. The essentialist thinks, I choose to. The non-essentialist thinks, it's all important. The essentialist thinks, only a few things really matter. The non-essentialist thinks, how can I fit it all in? The essentialist says, what are the trade-offs? What am I giving up to take on this new thing? The non-essentialist reacts to what's most pressing. The essentialist pauses to discern what really matters. The non-essentialist says yes to people without really thinking. The essentialist says no to everything except the essential. I mentioned it last time. Which is your default? Do you say yes to everything? And it's a rare exception to say no? Or is the default to say no? My plate is full. My obligations are overwhelming. To be true to my commitments, the default is no. Unless you can convince me. Unless it is so compelling to say yes. Which is your anchor? Which is your default? Do you always say yes and it's a rare exception to say no? Or do you say no because what you're committed to matters more and it takes a lot of convincing to say yes? Because remember, every yes to something is a no to something else. Every time you say yes to sit on another board, to volunteer in another place, to attend another event, to go out on another social call, every yes to something is a no to something else. And you know what the no usually is too? Your beautiful little children's faces. It's a no to your exercise. It's the lab report at your next doctor's visit. You're saying no to exercise. You're saying no to enough sleep. You're saying no to challenging your mind. You're saying no to the margin you need in life. Every yes to something is a no to something else. It's a paradigm shift. It's a total different way of looking at it. Not, I can say yes to everything. Time will expand and I'll fit it all in and I'll make it all happen and everyone will be happy and we'll sing Kumbaya and the curtain will fade. It doesn't work that way. Every yes to something is a no to something else. There's a trade-off in all that we do. And the way to evaluate every opportunity that presents itself is not that it's an automatic yes unless it's a no, but it's an automatic no unless it's a yes. I mentioned last time that McKeon in Essentialism says it's like cleaning your closet. You know, the best way to clean your closet, you become very emotionally attached to everything in your closet. Things that don't fit, things that have holes or are torn, things that are out of style. You've got the fat you section, the thin you section, the medium you section, the section of you from the 80s, from the 90s, maybe it'll come back. You've got the section that your favorite shirt from college, the section that... And so what ends up happening every time you start to clean your closet? You walk out of your closet and it looks pretty much the same. So he says, here's the criteria you use to clean your closet. You hold up every article of clothing and you ask yourself the following question. If I didn't own this yet, would I buy it now? That's the metric through which you clean your closet. If I didn't own it already, would I buy it now? And that's how you should evaluate everything in your life. If I wouldn't agree to join this, to do this, to attend that, to make that commitment, knowing what I know now, if I wouldn't agree to it now, then get out of it. Then get off of it. Because everything is a trade-off. Every yes to something is a no to something else. The non-essentialist takes on too much and work suffers. The essentialist chooses carefully in order to do great work. The non-essentialist feels out of control. The essentialist feels in control. The non-essentialist is unsure of whether the right things got done. The essentialist gets the right things done. The non-essentialist feels overwhelmed and exhausted. The essentialist feels joy on the journey. It's an amazing thing. Pruning. Anyone here garden? You have pruning clippers. You prune. Why do you prune? If something's growing, let it grow. Isn't that, after all, the whole goal of gardening? That something grow and blossom and expand? Why would you prune? Why do you prune? Because when you cut off the non-essential, when you remove the overgrowth, then and only then can it blossom. Can it fully realize its potential? That's what pruning is about. How do you say to prune in Hebrew? One of the categories of forbidden labor on Shabbos, a subcategory, is zomer. Zomer is to prune. If you're in Israel and you're instructing your gardener that certain bushes need pruning, you would tell him he has to lizmor, zomer, he has to prune. It's not a coincidence that every morning in our prayers, we have a section called psukim, psuke, verses dizimra, verses that are there for pruning. We sit at the Shabbos table and what do we sing? Pruning songs, zmiros. Why does that Hebrew word zmiros, psuke, dizimra? What are we trying to achieve when we say those verses every morning, when we sit at our Shabbos table and sing those songs? We are trying to prune away the distractions, to remove the extraneous, to break away from that which is dead, and to finally blossom forth. Psuke Dezimra is an exercise in intentionality, in concentration, in mindfulness. Psuke Dezimra is the time that we meditate before we pray so that we can be focused. Because if we want to blossom with focus in our conversation with the Almighty, we first have to prune and remove that which is growing extraneously. This is also familiar to us from another time of year, Passover, Pesach. What are we consumed by? Different people to different degrees, different levels of OCD. before Passover, we have to search and destroy the chametz. What's chametz? Leavened bread. What's leavened bread? On the holiday of Passover, we have an obligation of eating the matzah. You have to eat the matzah. And yet, you're not allowed to not only eat, you can't own any chametz. What's the difference between matzah and chametz? Same ingredients. Both are made from flour mixed with water. What's the only difference between the two? Time. The impact of time. That mixture allowed to sit lazy, procrastinating, bloated. That's chametz. Mixed, baked, quickly, alacrity, enthusiasm, zeal. That's matzah. Only difference between the two is the impact of time. Pesach is 8 days of the year, week of the year, that we don't eat chametz. We get to go back to it after Pesach. Some go back very quickly. But it's a symbol of the entire year. That our entire year should be matzah year, not a chametz year. We are so obsessed and consumed by trying to find the chametz in our homes because that is a symbol of the chametz in our lives. Where is there wasted time? Where is there inefficient time? Where is there wasted energy? Where is the laziness and the procrastination? Where have I been reactive rather than proactive to fashion the life to make me the best me I can be? We have a very bizarre custom. The night that we check for the chametz in our homes, we put out 10 pieces of bread. Who puts out the 10 pieces of bread? So you have young children, they put it out. Somebody who lives alone puts out the 10 pieces of bread, and then they go search for the 10 pieces of bread. It doesn't sound like a very sincere search. What's the custom about? Rabbi Osher Weiss, great scholar, explains, you know why the custom is we put out the bread, then we search for it? Because by putting out the bread, then searching for it, we are acknowledging and admitting that we are responsible for the chametz in our lives. It's Covey's notion of the here, of the have, versus be. If I'm searching for the chametz that you put out, the problem is your fault. It's the condition around me. It's everyone else. If only I had a house with no chametz. But my putting out the chametz is an admission that I can change my circumstance. That I can be the thin person, the patient person, the kind person, the person who saves money, the person who's disciplined. I can be responsible. We're finishing up with this. This time of year, resolutions. Every year, data shows that the biggest spike in gym membership occurs when? January. Second week of January. With the New Year come resolutions, and by far the most popular is not to start attending Rabbi Goldberg's classes, unfortunately. The most popular resolution is to get in shape. But statistics show that by the second week of February, just a month later, 80% of the new members of the gym stop coming. By a month later, not 10 years later, not a year later, not 6 months later. By 1 month later, 80% of the people who've signed up for the gym stop coming. And it's not just weight loss or exercise. While 45% of Americans make New Year's resolutions, only 10% are successful in keeping them. Why? Why? Because the solution is outside of themselves versus inside. There was a great Rebbe of Kalanimus Kalman Shapiro, the Piazetzna Rebbe, murdered by the Nazis. An incredible, incredible person, personality. It's worth your learning more about. He wrote a spiritual diary. Not a diary about what I had for breakfast and who I got to find what I said. A spiritual diary. And in the spiritual diary, he has the following entry. Writes the Piazetzna Rebbe, if you want to know if you've progressed on your spiritual path over the years, the way to judge is to look at your resolution, at your inner drive, and not at your wishes. Only the inner drive with which you work to attain your desired goal is called resolution. If you don't work, but rather you just want, that's not called a resolution. It's just some wish. You wish for yourself to be blessed with that desired objective. The pauper who works to sustain himself is a drive. He's doing something constructive. But the wish that I'll find $1 million is just a wish to be rich. It's not a resolution. Every Jew would like to be a tzaddik, righteous. But that's no more than a wish. He'd like to wake up in the morning and find himself, oh, I'm a tzaddik, I'm righteous. Only the level and state of being that you seriously work toward can truly be called a resolution. You know why only 10% of the people keep the resolution? Because they never made a resolution. All they articulated was a wish. I wish I were thin. I wish I were rich. I wish I were popular. I wish I got along with. I wish I had more time. I wish, I wish, I wish. As long as something's a wish, it might as well be a self-help book. It's a wish. It's outside. To really make change, said the Piazetz Nerebbe, you have to transform the wish into a true resolution. What's the difference between a wish and a resolution? A wish is in the air. A wish means I want to wake up one morning and have won the wish. A resolution has a plan. A resolution has goals. A resolution has metrics. A resolution has a deadline. A resolution charts a course to make a change, to be proactive, to show responsibility. Dr. Gail Matthews, a psychology professor at Dominican University in California, did a study. She found you are 42% more likely to achieve your goals just by writing them down. If you didn't take anything else away from tonight, take this. You are 42% more likely to achieve your goal just by writing it down. Now, why that works, we're out of time for. You confront it, you have to verbalize it, it forces you to articulate it, you leave it in a place where you'll be reminded of it. The mechanism with which it works, fascinating. But just the fact that it works is enough for tonight. 42% more likely to make your resolution, not your wish. Your wish, you have zero chance of making it true. But your resolution, your goal, 42% more likely if you write it down. Michael Hyatt, I mentioned him last time as well. I highly, highly encourage and endorse his podcasts. They're called This Is Your Life. You listen to them, 40 minutes long, fantastic. He talks about the best goals have these qualities. Specific enough to focus and direct your energies. They're measurable. You can keep track of your progress. They're actionable, with clear initiating verb that prompts specific activity. They're risky enough to leverage our natural tendency to rise to challenges. They're time-keyed, so you're prompted exactly when to act. They're exciting enough to inspire and harness the power of your intrinsic motivation. And they're relevant to the greater context of your life. To be a realistic goal or a resolution which will come to fruition, it should meet these criteria. It can't just be, I want to be a good person. It's got to be, I want to be healthy. It's got to be specific. So let's take health. Specific, weight loss. I want to lose X amount of pounds. Measurable. I will go on the scale every this increment to see specifically if I've met that goal of weight loss. Actionable. Here's what I need to do to lose weight. Risky. If I tell people around me that I plan on losing weight, I'm taking a risk because I've involved them. It's time keyed, so I know when to act. I'm going to exercise the same time and the same day. I'm going to hire a trainer or hold myself accountable. It's exciting. I'm not going to take on an exercise I hate doing. I'm going to craft an exercise or eating habits which I enjoy. And lastly, it's relevant. Here's why it's important to be healthy in my greater overall life. And so I want to end tonight by giving you a 30-day challenge, which incorporates and summarizes everything that we spoke about tonight. The 30-day challenge is as follows. Over the next 30 days, let's all work on going from being reactive to proactive, to being intentional in all that we do, not going downstream like a dead fish, but swimming upstream, making proactive choices, showing responsibility. Let's be mindful of the language we use. Over the next 30 days, catch yourself. Don't say, I can't. Say, come on, let's practice. Don't say, I can't. Say, I don't. Be careful of the language you use. Don't focus on have. If only I had. I wish I didn't have. Focus on be. Set realistic, achievable goals. Write them down. You're 42% more likely to achieve them. And ask others to hold you accountable. I'm trying to lose weight and get healthy, so I challenged a dear friend to weight loss, and we text each other every few days our weight on the scale that morning. If you involve and include others and create accountability for the goal you set, now you have greater pressure and motivation to achieve it. So here's the challenge. By the next session of this course, by part three, what will be different about your life? Who in this room will have begun to lose weight? Who will start reading a book? Who will have created more margin? Who will be more patient? Who will be more loving? Who will be more giving? What will be different about you by the next session of this course? And what do you need to decide tonight? And how will you be proactive to make it a reality? Thank you very much.